religion in the older times was no different than Canaanite religion. And the Lord was simply a god, no different from other Canaanite gods. So that the starting point for Wellhausen's system is not Mosaic revelation, but early Semitic heathenism. Start out with that, rather than Mosaic revelation. Start out with early Semitic heathenism. And what Wellhausen's system is it runs from that heathenism up to Moses. So what, according to the biblical structure, is the beginning, the Mosaic era, the Mosaic revelation, for Wellhausen is the end. That's where everything is moving. Particularly as you come into the prophetic movement, prophetic idea of monotheism, centralization of worship, and ultimately working out of the implications of that in the Levitical legislation and the detailed ritual. That's the final point. In the process of doing that, changing, you see the whole structure and line of progress, the prophets are left hanging in the air. Because prophets then are no more reformers standing on the foundation of Moses. The prophets don't proclaim the old ways and call the people back to them. The prophets are innovators. They're proclaiming new ways. So that the function of the prophets is not to defend and proclaim the way of Moses, you might say, that originally had been revealed over against heathenism, and to call Israel to the back to their origins as distinct from heathen origins. But the prophets lead the people by their ethical preaching from early heathenism and bring them finally to Moses. That's what the Wellhausen scheme does. They lead the people by their ethical preaching out of heathenism and really bring them to Moses. In quotes, the Moses of Wellhausen system. Now that's basically Hallwerder's assessment of Wellhausen system, and I think it gives you some insight into it. Gives you somewhat of a handle on it that is useful. If you read his Prolegomena of the History of Ancient Israel, it's an enormously complex book, and I think this presentation of Hallward is helpful in seeing some of the implications of it. But then his comment is that the history of opposition to Wellhausen's theory is mostly directed against various details of the system rather than getting at the heart of it. And of course, knocking at details of it are useful too. But according to Hallward's approach here, the heart of the system is the centralization issue. And that's the key point in the whole system. And that's why, as I mentioned, he said at the beginning of his article, few Bible readers realize that in this phrase, the place where the Lord your God shall choose, we are confronted with the root problem of modern Old Testament study. See, that's why he feels there's such significance to that. Now, as I also mentioned, I think maybe Hallward has overstated his case. But still, there is something here that has enormous implications. Now, what he goes on to do is this, then. He points out that there are examples in the historical books, covering the time from the judges up to and including the time of the kingdom period, multiplicity of altars is obviously referred to. From the time of the judges up to the time of the kingdom period. Multiplicity of altars. Obviously referred to in the historical books. And he says it's difficult to be satisfied with saying that the worship in each case at these different altars was illegal. He points out that there are examples of worship that were illegal, not in accordance with the law. For example, in Judges 17, the worship that Micah promoted, that's one of those latter chapters in the book of Judges where that private sanctuary was set up with the Levites, obviously with the idolatry involved, illegal worship. Also, the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, in setting up his calves at Bethel and at Dan, it certainly was a rival worship to the worship in Jerusalem, and as such was condemned as a sin. But all of that, he says, does not take away from the fact that in this period, the multiplicity of altars is not condemned but sanctioned. Now, for example, he points out a number of cases. In the case of Elijah, that's in the time of Ahab, in the northern kingdom, where he opposes Baal worship and the prophets of Baal. After that showdown, so to speak, on Mount Carmel, 1 Kings 19, when Jezebel goes after Elijah, he becomes very discouraged. Perhaps that after, let me see the context here. He's fleeing from Jezebel. He goes out into the wilderness in 1 Kings 19, verse 10, as he's in a cave resting, and the Lord says, "What do you do here, Elijah?" He says, "I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with a sword, and I am left. They seek to take my life, also to take it away." One of Elijah's complaints is the people of the Lord had thrown down his altars, in the plural, and had abandoned the altars of the Lord, and apparently were following the heathen altars. It wasn't long before that where up on Carmel himself, Elijah erected an altar. In 1 Kings 18, verse 31, Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob. With the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord. He made a trench about the altar. And then he prayed, and the Lord responded to that prayer. And you don't get the slightest hint that there is any illegality connected with his building an altar, apart from the Jerusalem altar. And you get the suggestion, at least, in 1 Kings 19, verse 10, that a point of valid criticism against the Israelites of that time was that they destroyed the Lord's altars. It is also at least of interest, as Hallward points out, that we never read once again, we never read once of prophetic opposition against multiplicity of altars. There is no element of the prophetic message that is explicitly directed against multiplicity of altars. Now, if that was an issue, you could, this is an argument from silence, which never is the strongest argument, but you could at least charge the prophets with neglect of this issue. Why didn't the prophets come out strongly against multiplicity of altars? The books of Samuel are particularly important. Samuel was a prophet. He was a reformer. He built various altars, and he sacrificed at various altars. In 1 Samuel chapter 9, he goes to a high place of Ramah and offers a sacrifice in a town named Ramah. In 1 Samuel 7 and 1 Samuel 10, he offers sacrifices at Mizpah. And in 1 Samuel 11, verse 15, he offers one at Gilgal. So you have explicit mentioning of Samuel offering at Ramah, Mizpah, and Gilgal. You also have the reference in 1 Samuel 16:2 of his making an offering in Bethlehem. Which seems to be quite a normal thing, because notice the context. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long wilt thou mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill thine horn with oil, go, I will send thee to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons. Go anoint one of the sons of Jesse." Samuel says, "How can I go? If Saul hear it, he will kill me." Saul was a king. If he's going to go anoint another king, Saul's going to oppose that. The Lord says, "Take an heifer with thee and say, I'm going to come to sacrifice to the Lord." That seems like it would have been such a normal practice for someone to take a heifer and go to Bethlehem to sacrifice that it would have aroused no curiosity whatever on the part of Saul. In a subsequent occasion, after David had been anointed, and Saul was still king, David was not at his place at the table of Saul in 1 Samuel 20. And it seems like when Saul's curiosity is aroused as to why David wasn't there, you find in 1 Samuel 20, verse 24, David hid himself in the field. When the new moon was come, the king sat down to eat. The king sat upon his seat, as at other times, even upon a seat by the wall. Jonathan arose. Abner sat by Saul's side, and David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul spoke not anything that day, for he thought, "Something hath befallen him. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean." In other words, it seems that it must have been some sort of a cultic meal, because the first thought is he wasn't ritually able to come. But then, comes past the second day, the month when David's place was empty, Saul said to Jonathan, "Why comes not the son of Jesse to the table, neither yesterday nor today?" Jonathan answered to Saul, "David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He said, let me go, I pray thee, for our family hath a sacrifice in the city. My brother hath commanded me to be there." So again, he went to Bethlehem. Why? To offer sacrifice. And his brother had commanded him to be there. And that was the reason why then he wasn't at Saul's table. So that local offering was apparently the custom in that time, and no one saw any deviation from the law because someone was going to a place to offer sacrifice. But then some say these were unstable times. The temple had not yet been built. And Deuteronomy 12:10 says, "When he giveth you rest from your enemies round about." Notice Deuteronomy 12, verse 10. "When you go over the Jordan, dwell in the land which the Lord your God giveth you to inherit. When he giveth you rest from all your enemies round about, so that ye dwell in safety, then there shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. In other words, after the Israelites achieve rest, then there will be this centralized worship. So that frequently the point is made, Deuteronomy says this, and that 2 Samuel 7:11 is the point at which those conditions were realized. Now, 2 Samuel 7 is that chapter which contains the promises of the Lord to David concerning his house, that the Lord was going to establish it forever. When David had asked if he could build a house for the Lord, and in verse 11 it says, "And as since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and have caused thee to rest from all thine enemies, also the Lord telleth thee that he will make thee an house." Now, some have tried to argue then that from any citation of multiplicity of altars prior to 2 Samuel 7, therefore, doesn't make the case, because multiplicity was permissible until the Lord gave rest and until this situation was established of peace in which centrality of worship could then function well. But even if that's the case, it doesn't help with the Elijah passage. And in addition, Absalom, for example, even after 2 Samuel 7:11, organized his revolution at a sanctuary in Hebron. 2 Samuel 15, David sanctions the wish of his son to go there and pay a vow. Again, excuses made about going somewhere to sacrifice. In 2 Samuel 15, verse 7, it came to pass after 40 years, Absalom said to the king, "I pray thee, let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed unto the Lord in Hebron. For thy servant vowed a vow while he was in Syria, saying, if the Lord shall bring me again to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord." And David grants that to his son, and of course he goes to Absalom, he goes to Hebron, and starts a revolution there. But the occasion for that is, again, paying a vow, offering a sacrifice. In addition, and these are Hallward's response to this 2 Samuel 7 thing, if external enemies are meant by this matter of rest or peace, Hallward says application of the rule of Deuteronomy 12 is only really possible during the time of Solomon, and then for very brief periods later. Because if you're talking about external enemies, almost constantly throughout Israel's history as a nation, there were external enemies. There were very short periods only where there was not threat from external enemies. So that Hallward says the rest referred to in Deuteronomy 12 does not have reference to external enemies, but to internal, and that the achievement of that condition really is referred to in Joshua 22, verse 4, right at the conclusion of the conquest. Joshua 22, verse 4. And in Joshua 22, after the conquest, then the 2.5 tribes are sent home. We read in verse 4, "Now the Lord your God hath given rest unto your brethren as he promised them. Now therefore return ye, get you unto your tents, unto the land of your possession, which Moses the servant of the Lord gave you on the other side. But take diligent heed to do the commandment and the law." So that he sees the rest referred to in the promises of Deuteronomy as fulfilled long before the time of David, fulfilled in the time of Joshua. Yeah.
Wasn't a consistent interpretation of Hebrews more back that up if Joshua had given them
come into the land.
Rest.
Yeah. It would fit with that, it would seem. All right, then to go a bit further. The Exodus 20, verses 24 to 26 passage. What is the point of the regulations there? Why only earth and uncut stones for construction of altars? Was that meant only for the wilderness? As Holwerda points out, it's not reasonable to conclude that this is reference only to the wilderness. It was meant for the time after entrance into Canaan. This was the kind of altar that was to be used. In fact, he says when it was given in Exodus 20, right at Sinai, there's no thought at that point of 40 years in the wilderness. The golden calf apostasy had not occurred. The law is being given at Sinai. The anticipation is that soon Israel will come into the promised land. So that he says what strikes us is, in the Exodus 20 passage, is that there were strong regulations on how the altar was to be built, the place it was to be located, which was to be removed from arbitrary choice of the people. Notice it says that in all the places where I record my name, I will come unto you. So the regulations on how it was to be built, the place it was to be located. But it gives no indication that only one place was to be used. And certainly it's clear that the practice during the time of Samuel corresponded to that law. There was more than one altar. So, Holwerda asks the question, how then do we harmonize Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 12? Do we adopt Wellhausen's conclusion? There was a long period of development, originally multiplicity of altar, development into centralization of altar. Well, he says, the question is, does Deuteronomy 12 demand centralization? And to him, that's the crucial point. Does Deuteronomy 12 demand centralization? And in the discussion of that, verse 14 becomes really a critical verse. You read in verse 14, I'll preface it with 13, take heed to thyself, that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of thy tribes, there shalt thou offer thy burnt offering. There shalt thou do all that I commanded. Not in every place, but in the place in one of thy tribes. He says you cannot stop with the first impression you may get from these verses. In one of thy tribes, Deuteronomy 12, 14, B'ahad Shivateka, in one of your tribes. According to Hebrew usage, that does not necessarily indicate only one, because frequently, this kind of an expression can have the same idea as the English word any. In any of your tribes. So that it could mean in any one of your tribes or in any number of your tribes. It's not explicitly clear. Now, what the Holwerda points out is the analogy with Deuteronomy 18:6. In Deuteronomy 18:6, you have the regulation. if a Levite come, and notice the King James translates this verse, from any of your gates, if a Levite come from any of thy gates out of all Israel, where he sojourned, and come with all the desire of his mind unto the place which the Lord shall choose, then he shall minister in the name of the Lord his God, as all his brethren the Levites do, stand there before the Lord. Now, the expression in the Hebrew is really identical with the difference of the main and the base preposition. Mea had she'areka, from one of your gates or from any of your gates. Well, the point is, the purpose is not a rule for a Levite coming from one particular gate, but for every Levite coming from any gate. If a Levite come, any Levite, come from any of thy gates. So that the expression can be translated permissibly either way, one of or any of. And depends to a large degree on the context of which meaning you're going to place on. But then you notice, getting back to Deuteronomy 12, verse 14, it says, in the place. Isn't that in the singular? If more than one place was meant, wouldn't it require a plural? In the places which the Lord shall choose. Well, again, not necessarily so. It may be, but not necessarily so. In Numbers chapter 16, verse 7. You read, in connection with the uprising or rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram in the camp in the wilderness, you read, this do, take you censers, Korah and all his company, put fire therein, put incense in them before the Lord tomorrow, and it shall be that the man whom the Lord doth choose, he shall be holy. Ye take too much upon you, ye sons of Levi. And Moses said unto Korah, here I pray you, and so forth. Now the point is here, the man whom the Lord doth choose, the man, ha-ish, which the Lord doth choose, the phrase which follows is identical there. But it's the man in the sense that the man is singular, but the question is if the office of priest and leader is to be confined to Moses and Aaron or extended to the 250. There's 250 people that are involved. So the choice is between two plurals. But the text says the man, singular. The meaning is clear in the context of Numbers. The men, whether two men or 250 men. The way of stating that is that the man whom the Lord will choose, but not necessarily exclusively only one man. Yeah, it's either Moses and Aaron or all these 250 people that were seeking the same status as Moses and Aaron. And the sign is going to be the man that the Lord will choose, but in the sense of more than one. I think exegetically you have to conclude on the basis of the expressions in the chapter itself that Deuteronomy 12 can mean one place and one tribe, or more than one place that the Lord will indicate in the land in any of the tribes. It can mean either. On the basis of the language used. So that really then Deuteronomy 12 says the same thing as Exodus 20 to 24. in Exodus 20, verse 24. In all the places where I record my name, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee. Additional factors which Holward says points in this direction are not in every place, but in the place. Not in every place, but in the place. Does that mean multiplicity versus centralization? He'd say, no, that's not the right way to put it. The question is not one or more, but whether the place is selected by human arbitrary means or by divine choice. Not in every place, but in the place. Is that multiplicity versus centralization? No. Question's not one or more, but whether the place is selected by human arbitrary means or by divine choice. That's the point. And at that point, there is consistency between Exodus and Deuteronomy. He also says that the motifs behind the specifications of Exodus 20 have been shown to have been prohibitions against precisely the kind of altar that existed in Canaan, that have been excavated. Israel was to have a distinctively different kind of altar than the heathen Canaanites were. Their worship was not to be confused with the Canaanite worship, but the point of the regulations there in Exodus is to make very clear that Israel's altar was to be distinctively different than the Canaanite altar. And he also says that Deuteronomy 12 says that all the offerings are to be brought at the chosen place or places. And then it is added, the whole family will appear with servants and Levites. Notice verse 18 of Deuteronomy 12. Thou must eat them before the Lord thy God in the place which the Lord thy God shall choose, thou, thy son, thy daughter, thy manservant, thy maidservant, and the Levite who is within thy gates. Now, what he points out is this. The whole family with servants and the Levite. Think of what that meant practically. For a city such as Dan, north of Galilee, 150 kilometers from Jerusalem. Minimally, three times a year at the feast. Plus, offerings at birth, free will offerings, other required offerings. The whole family was to make a trip to Jerusalem. Now he, in his article, discusses what this would mean in a European context, and it would be roughly an absence of a week, minimally. Be like us today, going to Florida or something, or perhaps further, to make these required offerings. What about the Levites? If there were many families in the village, he could be on the road the whole year. Holward says, why stay in the northern town? Why not just stay in Jerusalem? Meet them when they come. He says it's impractical. It couldn't be carried out. His conclusion is that Israel never had a law that bound the cult to one place, but always lived under a law that provided for local places next to the central sanctuary. originally at Shiloh, later at Jerusalem. That doesn't mean there wasn't a central sanctuary and there wasn't primacy of sanctuary connected with the ark and the temple. But not to the point of exclusiveness and illegality of any offering at any other altar or sanctuary. So he says what was regulated was the place where altars were to be built, not just arbitrarily anywhere, but at places that the Lord in some way made clear. How, by theophany or whatever, is not explicitly described, but it's restricted to places that the Lord in some way indicates. The material out of which altars were to be built was regulated, and the offerings that were to be brought were regulated. So that God provided for altars scattered. That doesn't mean there was an altar in every village or every few miles, just arbitrarily everywhere, because in Deuteronomy 12 too, not 12 verse 2, but in Deuteronomy 12 also, it says in verse 21, if the place which the Lord thy God has chosen to put his name there be too far from thee, then thou shalt kill of thy herd and of thy flock which the Lord hath given thee as I have commanded thee, and thou shalt eat in thy gates whatsoever thy soul desireth. In other words, animals could be killed and eaten in places other than going to the sanctuary to slaughter animals. Distance might make that impractical. So it sounds like they weren't just everywhere throughout the land. There was some restriction in connection with the Lord's designation of certain places, but not restriction to a central sanctuary with all other altars illegal. So that God provided many altars to keep his people from the temptation all around them and to keep them in fellowship with himself in accordance with the provisions in the sacrificial system which he had made, without making that system almost impossible to follow because of the extreme distances involved. Now, basically, that's Hallward's view. I'd say that you find roughly the same position in Thompson when you read his commentary and in his introduction. You want also to see a very similar viewpoint, Manley's The Book of the Law, that I've asked the grad students to read, has a whole chapter on this. And basically, he comes to the same conclusion. He says, as to centralization, the language used is capable of having this interpretation read out of it or into it. That's this language here. The real force of the contrast in Deuteronomy 12 is not between many Yahweh altars in one, but between those of the Canaanites to other gods whose name is to be destroyed and the place where the name of Yahweh shall abide. It's not their number, but their character which is in question. Whether the words be read as pointing to one center or more than one, they do not exclude the possibility of other altars duly authorized. Indeed, the rule in Deuteronomy 16, 21, 22 contemplates the existence of such. In Deuteronomy 27, the erection of one is commanded. So it's not multiplicity of altars that is argued against in Deuteronomy. Another book, H.M. Siegel, The Pentateuch, Its Composition and Authorship, has a section on centralization of worship, page 87 and following. Now, I could read that, but I think our time's about up. Again, it's basically the same conclusion. Manley, Thompson, Siegel. I think that generally the view that is being followed today is that multiplicity of altar was not excluded in ancient Israel by the Deuteronomic legislation. Now, it seems to me, just to to draw this to a conclusion, our whole introductory section, that there are three issues in Deuteronomic studies that are significant, on which presently there is a very solid orthodox counterpart to critical theory. The first is this whole structure of the book. And Klein's work and others with this treaty covenant analogy, I think, have given a good argument in connection with the integrity and unity of the book of Deuteronomy over against critical theory. The second issue is this matter of centralization of worship, central to Wellhausen's view. I think these positions of Hallwarda, Thompson, Manley, and others face that issue and give an alternative position that puts the issue on quite a different perspective than Wellhausen does. The third matter that we can't discuss, and I can't get into it, it's complex and it's detailed. Is the matter of this so-called progression in law code, J.E. code, covenant code, Deuteronomic code, holiness and priestly code, in other words, a sequence of law codes, with development and change in some kind of historical progression. Manley deals with that beautifully in this book, the Book of the Law, Studies in the Date of Deuteronomy. He points up numerous problems with that scheme of J, E, D, and P as simply a progressive development of successive codes. Now, that requires a detailed consideration of specific laws, how they're reflected in covenant code, how in Deuteronomy, how in the priestly, and what conclusions you can draw from that. But Manley's discussion of that, I think, is an excellent response, so to speak, to this thing of Wellhausen. So that in those three areas, structure and integrity, centralization worship issue, sequence of code, within the last few years, comparatively speaking, there's been an enormous amount of work done from an evangelical perspective that I think is of great value in countering a lot of these positions that have dominated the field in the study of the Book of Deuteronomy. Well, our next class hour, we get into Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 32 to 40. I think it'd be good if you'd read the larger section in which that fits, Deuteronomy 1:1 to 4:49, and come prepared with your summary statements, and Mr. Donnelly will lead our discussion there.